Spring turkey season is upon us, and don't be caught out in the woods without having Onyx Hunt on your phone. One feature Onyx has that is often overlooked for turkey hunting is their recent imagery filter with their elite memberships. This imagery is updated week to week, and it comes in extremely handy, especially when you're trying to find these gobble zones where these turkeys will go out in a high spot on a fresh clear cut and strut around all day long. Actually, I was just looking at it on Onyx where the timber company just came into Andrew's Club and did a very small clear cut along this creek. And I can see the high spots on the topographical map, but also I can see exactly where they mulch. And those are going to be hot spots for finding gobblers, especially mid-morning after they get off their hens, getting up on these little high spots in this fresh, small clear cut along the creek and strutting and gobbling all day long. If you want to give Onyx a try, you can actually download it for free, try it for 7 days. And if you decide to purchase, you can use the promo code Southern and save on your premium and elite memberships. So going into this turkey season, know where you stand with Onyx.
If you're looking to throw some optics on your turkey gun this spring, look no further than the Vortex Defender ST. This is the red dot we're going to be running this season. We're excited about it. This thing's built like a tank, super lightweight, super long battery life, everything you need in a good turkey red dot. And if you want to get a discount on that red dot or any other Vortex optic, go to eurooptic.com and use the code SGN10 to get a discount. That's eurooptic.com, code SGN10. If you live in the Gulf Coast region, you need to find yourself at the EcoWild Expo May 10th through the 12th in Mobile. It is the premier outdoor expo for the Gulf Coast region, and we're going to be there. We're going to have a booth. We're super excited about it. Can't wait to meet you guys that live down there. We absolutely love the Gulf Coast region, so to be a part of this show, we're super excited about. We're going to have past podcast guests there at our booth for you to talk to, guys who are relevant for your area, who you can talk to, you can pick their brain, you can joke with them, laugh with them, tell them your story, whatever you want to do. It's going to be awesome time. We're already working on some past podcast guests, but hey, if you live in this area and you have a suggestion for someone you want to see at that show, write in and we'll see if we can get them. There's going to be all kinds of exhibitors at the show that are focused on hunting, fishing, conservation, and recreation. There's going to be activities for the whole family there. They got axe throwing, archery. They're going to have our podcast booth. And then for the kids, they got touch tanks, a honeybee exhibition, a raptor show, kids fishing tank, BB gun range, and a butterfly house. So you're going to love it. Your kids are going to love it. It's going to be an awesome time. So head on over to ecowildexpo.com to get more information on the show and to go ahead and grab your tickets. And hey, mark it on your calendar, May 10th through the 12th. Be there. We want to see you and we're excited to talk to you. So we'll see you at the EcoWild Expo this May 10th through the 12th at the Mobile Convention Center in Mobile, Alabama. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Southern Outdoorsman Podcast. We've got a scenic recording environment today on the back porch of Mr. Alan Summerford. Alan, how are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Oh, dude, I appreciate you inviting us into your home. This has been awesome. Like, you have, for Alabama, dude, you have one of the most impressive trophy rooms I think I've ever seen, for sure.
Thank you very much.
It is kind of crazy. I didn't know that many drop time bucks existed in the state of Alabama.
Yeah, I got a thing for trashy ones.
Yeah. Oh, man. You got Jacob Myers over here.
Yeah, it's like me and my women, dude. I appreciate you inviting us up because one of our mutual buddies, Kyle Leibarger, we've known him for a couple years now. He originally, probably 6 months ago, said, man, you ought to get my buddy Alan on the podcast. And I'm like, okay, what's the story? He said, man, he killed some really big deer, really impressive deer hunter, whole 9 yards. He's like, y'all talk to him. And I finally got to meet you at the Weavers event that we did, the meetup over there back in January, and then got to meet with you guys again at NWTF. And it was a blast kind of talking to you and kind of like learn a little bit more about you. But after spending some time with you here talking, I'm like, oh, now I'm like, you know, I was pretty excited about the podcast. And I was like, maybe we'll do a little bit on the land management side because you do a lot with, you know, both Kyle and Land Legacy and also trying to do your own consulting now. But now I'm like, dude, we just got to talk straight deer tactics because I'm like, there's way more here than even I had even imagined. But to kind of kick us off, talk to us a little bit about, like, where are we at right here in the state of Alabama, and, like, what is, your family's history, like, with this region of the state?
So, we're in North Alabama in Morgan County, and the Summerfords have been here for forever, pretty much when the town was incorporated. But basically, we've been my great-granddad, he started buying land around, and if he would find a piece of land that he would buy for cheap, and then whenever something would come available close by, he would buy that. He would sell that and buy that. And so we kind of got our farm's scattered across a long area of Fayetteville, and it's not all contiguous. It's all just kind of just a block here or there. But so we've been running cattle on it ever since then. And so I'm like a fifth generation cattle farmer and born and raised right here. And we've managed the farm to raise cattle. We sell herd sires and beef. And that's kind of just always been our thing. And my granddad, he actually had a country store. He used to sell beef from the farm, and he killed hogs and stuff. And we would ship sausage up to Chicago on the train in the wintertime. I mean, we'd just been, he owned a general store. He sold everything from socks to guns and everything in between. But so we've just always been, he's a really good businessman, always been really, really good about, you know, seeing things, learning about things, and knowing where to put his money.
Yeah.
And so that's how we kind of got the farms down in South Alabama. Lamb was going for extremely cheap back then, back in the early 80s, I guess. And he found those little farms down there and paid almost nothing for them because they weren't worth a whole lot back then. Mm-hmm. One of the farms, I think, pretty much the CRP payments pretty much paid for the farm. And so he's just really, really business-minded and made really, really good investments. And we actually ran cattle down there for several years. Probably 10 or 15 years until he got to where he was hard for him to go down there and take care of it and oversee it. Mm-hmm. But since then, we've sold all the cattle from there, leasing one out to a cattle farmer, leasing another one out to a row cropper, and the other one just got set out to pine trees.
Got you. So that's the interesting thing about you guys is kind of growing up in this like cattle farming family. And a lot of people think, when you think of cattle farmers, like to me, deer hunters kind of go hand in hand with it. But it's not always like the highest quality deer hunting just because you're typically running cattle. So it's like, you know, if cattle are out there, you know, grazing pastures, it mixes a little bit of timber, but it's not like a ton of habitat for whitetails. What has been like y'all's family background getting into deer hunting? I mean, is that something that your granddad was real big into and your dad and everybody else?
Yeah, so like everybody around here grew up quail hunting. And quail and rabbit is all small game. And but my granddad, when we bought those farms in West Alabama, was loaded with deer. Especially back then, there was just tons and tons of deer, way too many. But he started going down there to work, and then he would hunt in the afternoons. And it's kind of a funny story. My dad was trying to get in touch with him down there one day, and he couldn't get in touch with him, so he called my uncle. He said, "Hey, you know where Daddy is?" And he said, "He's probably out hunting." He's like, "No, he ain't hunting." He goes, "Yeah, he's already killed like six deer this year." And he's like, he was going down there and hunting in the afternoons and everything. Well, whenever I got old enough, he started carrying me down there to hunt. And so he actually taught me, you know, how to shoot and hunt and all that kind of stuff and got me interested in it. He was with me when I killed my first deer, when I killed my first turkey. And but he had never really hunted much his whole entire life either. So he didn't really know the ropes about hunting. We just had a lot of deer. He would plant some food plots and stuff, and we always saw a lot of deer, and we'd shoot them. And man, he never looked for a blood trail or anything. He'd just walk in the woods and go find them.
So with that kind of like background, kind of like, you know, your granddad especially kind of being a big influence for you and kind of like learning from him, but also like kind of get on your own. One interesting thing that we're going to talk about is like all these properties are different size properties. They're not all just like huge, huge, huge properties. Like one of your best properties, you were talking to us earlier, is only 40 acres and only 20% or only 20 acres of it's huntable.
Right.
Which is kind of interesting because a lot of people think, you know, oh, you know, this guy's hunting cattle farms. You know, he's got hundreds, if not, you know, a few thousands acres or more of big land masses that you can really go and put a lot of time in. But like, it's not necessarily the case on a lot of these properties. There's some properties that I'm sure are a little bit bigger than others.
Right.
But it's interesting kind of seeing how you've learned to hunt these properties, but also even venturing on private or public land and having success on public land, especially on some pretty high pressure public land, and using what you've learned there on the private to apply on the public side. Getting over to talking about like some of the different properties and kind of like where we're at now, when you're talking about like habitat, can you talk about like the difference of habitat on all these different properties that y'all have, but also like how they all differ, but also how the deer hunting differs on all of them?
Right. So Morgan County, it's a little more open. About the only place you really have much habitat is where it was either too wet to farm or, you know, for whatever reason, you just can't get there, can't really get into it. It's not really good for anything else but habitat. And most of that is just trees. It's just timber. And so a lot of very little small pockets of place that a deer would even live. And you can kind of use that to your advantage in some ways because those smaller spots right there, for instance, that one farm with 20 acres, I've got one stand on it. I do not hunt anywhere else on the farm. I hunt that one stand when the wind's perfect. I've got it set up. I've got one little food plot in there, good bedding all the way around it. And I'm very, very picky about how I hunt that stand. I won't hunt it, but maybe one or two sits a whole entire year. But I know what day to go and sit on that property. The other farms, you know, one farm's a row crop farm. It's a really, really big farm. And a little over half of it is all row crop, and which is, you know, you think it's really, really good for the deer. But actually, we actually had bigger deer on it when it was a cattle farm. Because we had, you know, a whole entire farm. And it was a cattle farm where it's not like what you see here. Everything's green and pretty and manicured. And, you know, you can see all the way across this whole place. If a deer was walk out there at 500 yards, you could see it. Down there, it wasn't like that when it was a cattle farm. A lot of native grasses, a lot of weeds, a lot of just, you know, brushy type fields, which is also really, really great deer habitat. As long as you knew where the cows were, you just hunt around them. And, but now it's row crop, which a lot of the row crop is just plowed under dirt. And in the whole wintertime, they plant some of them cover crops, which is a good food source. So I don't really have to plant food plots on it anymore. But it changed it a little bit. And you have to really work on your habitat a whole lot more when it's row crops, because the row crops aren't growing your deer. The habitat is. And then you've got the other farm down there is all a big pine plantation. So it's a totally different thing. You got to do some burning and some habitat work in that. And it's a lot of food plots. Then we got a farm in Giles County, and it's a timber farm, and it's got a lot of little open fields and stuff in there, and I've done a lot of management in the timber. Has some of the biggest, prettiest white oaks you could ever think of. Great places to bow hunt, but let me tell you, cut you white oaks because it'll make it even better. Now, I kept a few little sections of white oaks that I wanted to look like that, to be open and be pretty and everything, but when I started cutting it and making it a little brushier, a little more open, running fire through there, the turkeys exploded and the deer got bigger. My food plot program has gone downhill because I haven't worried so much about putting everything in the food plots since I realized food plots aren't what's growing your deer. It's your habitat. And so so that farm's a little bit different. And but all in all, you still hunt the same way, but you just have a little bit different thing. You have to be a little more careful on a small farm than you do a big farm. You can't take any chances on a small farm to bump a deer. I mean, if you bump him off, he's off on your neighbors or who knows where. So you have to be super, super careful. Whereas on a bigger farm, you may can get away with a deer seeing you drive in or something like that. He's still going to run away from you and be on your farm, but he's not going to leave you as quick as one on a small farm will.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about, just to lay the groundwork a little bit more, when we just walked around in your house and saw your bucks, man, it's ridiculous. I mean, the mass on these deer, it's the kind of stuff that you go and see at like a deer show where there's outfitters advertising for like a Kansas hunt, and you just got these giant base, huge bucks. That's what you're killing here in Alabama, like very like high level deer for Alabama. And you talked a little bit about here in Morgan County, you got like a low deer density and the deer haven't been here as long. And that might be a factor. Can you just talk about that a little bit, like the deer densities in the different places you hunt, like maybe here versus Pickens County versus sure. Giles County, Tennessee?
So I remember seeing the very first deer track here in Morgan County. I was about 15 years old, which I'm 39 now. But I remember running home telling my dad I found a deer track. I mean, a deer track, and it was probably just a doe and probably just traveling through. But the deer kind of started populating this area a little bit, and that was when we had the absolute best hunting. There was super low deer density. Hadn't been deer here since the 70s. And so the habitat actually had a lot of the things that the deer would select for, but hadn't been over-browsed. So these deer were growing really, really rapidly. They were growing big, and a lot of them. And it's like there wasn't a lot of deer, but when you had a deer, he had potential to be the best that he could be. And but you still got to wait. Kill them when they're five. Don't shoot these three-year-old really, really good deer. Wait. Let them mature. Let them get big, because then they start expressing all those really cool genes that you don't see when they're 3 years old.
Drop tines.
Drop tines.
Drop tines galore in this house, let me tell you.
And so you just got to be patient, let that deer, you know, get to the age, be careful about hunting. Don't mess him up when he's three. Don't hunt him when he's three. You know, let him feel secure in there, and then he's going to be there when he's five because he's always felt safe there.
Mm-hmm. And well, and another thing, one reason I bring that up is because there might be some people who are like, well, he's got all this great private land, and it's high dollar private, but it's really not. It's really how you're managing the deer and how you're hunting the places and how you treat it. Because we even have some guys on public ground who are down closer to where we're from who kill deer in similar caliber to these deer for down there. And they're passing 3.5, 4.5 year old deer on public ground, on high pressure public ground. And they have that higher level of success that nobody else is having. So it's not that you have just like incredible, ridiculous properties. It's kind of the work that you're putting in and how you're hunting the properties and what you're taking off of those properties. Like, you're very intentional about all the stuff. It's not happening by accident, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. So like, you know, I've hunted a little bit of public land too. So like you've got two things. If you're hunting private land, you have to be doing the work to get these deer. You can't just go show up, plant a little food plot, and be consistent at killing giant deer. You've got to do the work of the habitat. You've got to get your fields in order. Most fields have got a lot of fescue and other non-native grasses and stuff in them. That's doing nothing for your deer. You got to get your timber in order. Most timber, and like a lot of the consults we go on, the timber is junk. Like, it may be some good species in there, but it's not feeding wildlife. It's 20-something-year-old cutover that's grown up into really, really thick stand of trees, and there's literally nothing on the forest floor. Or even if you've got great big hardwoods, big, beautiful hardwoods, I mean, on a great acorn year, you're producing 200, 250 pounds of food for a year, and that's it. So you've got to cut some trees. You've got to open it up. You've got to run some fire. And, I mean, that's my biggest tool is fire. I run fire through everything. And so if you're going to be on public land, you do the work scouting. You do a lot of work scouting to kill a big deer. If you're going to do it on private land, you got to do a lot of work to the habitat.
Yeah, I love that. That's actually a great kind of segue into the rest of this conversation too. But I want to talk about your tactics hunting these places, because it's pretty interesting, and it sounds like you're extremely careful and meticulous about how you hunt these properties. And like, I'm just looking at this property we're on now, and it's very gentle terrain. Like, you're not hunting harsh terrain features or anything like that. It looks like the low spots out here where you got the trees, and I'm assuming those woodlots are pretty open unless you've done something to them.
Now those woods are fairly thick right there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot, it floods a lot. So like, it looks here from its closed canopy, but if you actually walk in there, it's okay. Waist high grasses and herbaceous type stuff. So like, it's got a lot of open areas in it. But yeah, so there's the farm down in the row crop farm I was talking about down in Pickens. It literally is flat as a table, just about. I mean, there are no terrain features that you can really use. There's a ditch here or there. You're using the structure of the land. So, like, you may have some areas of, you know, overgrown type field, brushier field. Then you got some areas of hardwoods. And so you're using all these little funnels and stuff like that, using the grasses. And they'll work the side of the slightest little bit of a slope in a field. They'll kind of work around just like they would do in the timber that's in, you know, big hill country or big, you know, mountainous type terrain. They'll use those same features. It's just they're very, very minute. Little ditches and creeks and stuff like that are huge. But, you know, like I said, it's same thing. You can manipulate the habitat to kind of draw them where you want them to be. Use the openness of the row crops to kind of know where they're not going to be and that kind of thing.
I want to mention this just early on the podcast, because you're talking about cutting timber and talking about kind of the tactics, but like the whole idea, if you own property, like cutting more timber than what most people would think of, and like whitetail hunters are very scared to cut timber. A story I've got, or it's interesting, is I've got an uncle, a great uncle of mine, who's got a big lease on an island in the Mississippi River. And traditionally they'd kill 130, 140 inch deer out there, but it was typically very, very open. It's a very large property, like 3,000 acres. And I think they lease like 1,800 of it. Some of it has row crop on it, and they barge, you know, equipment over because it floods out every year. But it was big open timber, and they had a storm come through. I think it was a couple tornadoes, knocked down a ton of timber, and then loggers came in and cleared out a bunch of stuff that was all tore up and cleared out a lot of the acreage. And some of the best deer hunting they ever had was the 6 to 7 years after that. That's right. It was all cut, deer numbers went up, but the quality of deer that were spending time there, that was foraging all that, because he was talking about, like, back then, like, you couldn't hang a tree stand. Like, he was walking in, my grand uncle's walking in, and this is, I'm talking, this is only like 15 years ago, walking in with a stepladder, like a 6 foot stepladder, to lean up against some smaller shrub trees so he could get up above some of that tall grass and brush and stuff to hunt. And he's killed 160, they've killed 160, 170, 180 deer out there consistently over that 7-8 year period. And then it's kind of slowed back down as it's kind of matured out. And there's less and less of that forage because they don't run fires on the property. They haven't cut anything else. And it's kind of aged back out. But they had a golden age of, you know, 6, 7, 8 years because of the flooding. The flooding would knock some of that stuff that grow back up and knock it back down and grow back up every spring or every summer. And it was unbelievable hunting for a long time. And I brought it up to him after the fact. This was probably a year or two ago about, like, because he was, they were like disheartening or disheartened when everything was cut down and trees got knocked down, these huge monster oaks, but just how good the hunting was. And he kind of opened his eyes about, like, hunting not only these thick areas, but having all that native habitat growing back up, and it was producing just monster whitetails. And those deer not only just came over there to rut, but would spend time out there during the dry periods of the year when it wasn't flooded out. Because, I mean, that island would flood. It had 8 to 10 foot of water across the whole island in the late spring, early summertime period. And just how much huge deer it was producing for, you know, through a short period of time. And it just makes you wonder, with more and more whitetail guys, especially like what you're talking about doing, how, like, when you open that canopy up, not only are you, like, having the habitat, but it also – a lot of bow hunters are like, man, I can't hunt that. Like, it's not huntable if I cut a lot of the timber. But it's like being strategic about how you do everything and be able to still hunt it, whether it's off the ground, whether it's through an elevated stand, a tree stand, saddle, whatever, but still, you know, have that open ground that those deer can truly thrive on.
Yeah, that open ground is key because, like, you know, you can do it with a pine plantation. You know, it's usually good for 2 or 3 years, and then it gets staged out again. So you just got to repeat fire. Like, you've got to have, or a disturbance. It may not be fire. It may be hack and squirt, or it may be, you know, cut some trees with a chainsaw. I mean, you don't really run fire. I can't run fire through these hardwoods behind the house. It's all bottom land. I mean, if you ran a fire through there, you would kill every tree in there. And it's not really made what fire's to do. But it actually floods. And so the flood is the disturbance that this part needs to keep it more open. It kills a lot of trees out. Beavers come in, and they'll make a little meadow. And so you've got to keep repeating that disturbance. So, like, the clear cut initially is great for 3 to 5 years, and then it's not. And so you repeat the disturbance.
Now, kind of getting to, like, what Andrew's talking about with, like, the hunting strategy and everything on a lot of these properties, one thing I think we can dive in pretty early on is the annual patterns on some of these properties.
Yeah.
And how important annual patterns are for even some of these small properties, of, like, the timing of when it's absolutely critical for you to hunt. After you've done all the work and everything and the habitat's perfect, how these annual patterns has helped you kill just a ton of these huge deer. Because you've talked about when we were upstairs, a lot of these big deer, some of them have came out of the same property, sometimes out of a lot of them out of the same tree during the exact same few days of the season, and it's not a huge property. So, like, what have you kind of learned when it comes to, like, annual patterns and timing the rut, and also maybe even paying attention to the does and the habitat that's really played a huge part of some of that success, especially on some of these smaller properties?
Right. So one property I've probably had the most success on, it's basically a big bedding thicket, and it's got a food plot that's right on the edge of the bedding thicket. Then it's kind of like open back behind it. Well, my access is through the open part of it, so the bedding thicket, it never sees anybody whatsoever. It's super, super secure. I manipulate it, you know, every 2 to 3 years with fire or whatever. But it's I learned when during the week of Thanksgiving is the time around here that I find the front that has the wind that I'm looking for. And I hunt that day. I see it in the forecast, I'll know it's coming 2 or 3 days before. And I remember one year, like, the biggest one up there, like, I was hunting that deer, and I knew it was going to be on Black Friday. My wife was like, hey, I really want to go Black Friday shopping. I'm like, oh, I've been waiting for this day. Like, this is the day to kill him. Because I know after that, I have a hard time finding them. Like, they just don't daylight.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I really know this is the day. Should I even ask her? I'm like, honey, please, please, please look. I will do whatever. Can I please, please hunt tomorrow morning? She's like, okay, fine, you can hunt. Sure enough, shot him at 7:45. I was like, I'm only going to hunt to about 8:30. And I was literally, I don't know. And then all of a sudden, there he is. So, like, you know, I knew that that was the week. I knew that that weather pattern was the pattern that I needed. And it happened. And nearly every single deer I kill is within a day or so of each other. But it's always on the same weather pattern that you're going to get during that week. Be in the tree that day. Make sure you don't mess it up.
Now, how long has it taken you to learn that, specifically on, like, say, that property?
And, well, and what and was all the properties are kind of the same way. Mm-hmm. It's not something you learn overnight. It's just, you know, watching deer, hunting a farm, knowing, like, watching what they do during this time, then, like, okay, then breaking it down. All right, well, in this area, I get pictures. Like, pictures are a huge thing. If I ever get a daylight picture of a buck, I've got a computer in there. It's all that that computer does. When I get a daylight picture of a target buck, it goes in that computer. If I can find that buck when he's 2 to 3 years old, a lot of times he will keep that same pattern when he's 5 or 6. And sometimes it's actually his pattern actually kind of shrinks down a lot of times when they get older. Their patterns, a lot of times, they'll daylight more when they get older, like really old, but it's in a smaller area. And if your core area is where he daylights, you know that he's been there these days and those kind of fronts. And I don't keep up with it like the other guy with the trail camera stuff. I'm not that crazy about it. But if he daylights in that week, then I start noticing patterns like, well, hey, this week they're starting to daylight. That's going to be the time to be in the woods. And it's usually right on the edge of the pre-rut, kind of what he's talking about, those first does mm-hmm. coming in heat. That's when those bucks are there showing up. That podcast you had like last week or so about the guy with the
Shane Parker, yeah.
Finding those does. I don't go that crazy extreme. Like, I don't even run cameras in the summer very much. I wait till about August to throw some minerals out, take an inventory, see what's there, and then know where I'm going to chase. But, like, it's crucial. Like, those high-quality bedding cuts, high-quality bedding areas are going to have the best bucks in the area.
I want to dive into that a little bit deeper. One thing I'm wondering about is how you determine where you're putting your trail cameras and how much pressure you're willing to put on the deer with those trail cameras. But also the other thing, when you're talking about a wind direction, are you talking about just a wind direction you can access and hunt cleanly, or a certain wind direction that buck is coming through on?
Access and hunt cleanly. Super, like, I will not, I don't care if it's the right week. I don't care if I know the deer's daylight, and if I can't access it right, I will not hunt it. Mm-hmm. There are places that are really, really great places that I don't. My number one spot in Tennessee this year, I never sat a single time. My best food plot, my best area, the best travel corridor, I never sat it a single time because every time I was up there, the wind was not quite perfect.
Yeah.
So I am super, super careful about access. Super, super careful about my wind. I mean, one of those deer up there, I was giving y'all a story, like, my wife had almost killed the deer the year before, and then I didn't even hunt him again for the rest of the year. I just let him just sit in there, be patient. Next year, I started getting pictures of him, like, yeah, I really want to kill this deer. I was actually hunting the deer. I saw the deer, and I was supposed to have the right wind. I saw the deer, and my wind was starting to shift. It was about mid-morning. It started to shift, and while the deer, I could still see the deer, and it's another thing about access. You want to be able to get in and out of your stand without deer seeing you. Well, I could absolutely do this. Saw the deer. He's heading towards where my wind's going to blow.
How far was he?
He was about 85 yards. And I knew the last thing, he was going back to bed down. I knew the last thing I wanted was him to go where his safe spot is and to smell me. So as soon as I saw that deer heading towards that way, I got out of my tree and hauled it out of there as fast as I could go. Came back a week later and killed him, coming out of that bedding thicket.
That was a perfect segue, because I was about to bring that up. I was about to bring up that exact story. So you got eyes on the deer, saw him going to bed, and literally jumped out of your tree and ran off.
Got
so
out
he
of
wouldn't
there.
Beat you or
Absolutely.
Wouldn't spook you.
I wanted him to know that he was safe there, because he felt safe there. He'd been feeling safe there for 2 years. The last thing I want to do is mess it up, because I was probably not going to kill him. He wasn't coming in the trail I wanted him to come down. He's probably not going to be in bow range. So most people would just keep sitting there, mm-hmm. maybe try to call at him, or I didn't even call at him, because I knew if I did call at him, how he was going to try to come to me if I called was going to just completely mess me up.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, my wind wasn't perfect. It was supposed to be. It was forecasted to be for whatever reason, it changed and it was not what it was supposed to be. I was like, got to get out.
Yeah, and this is an interesting subject for me because, like, we come from a public land background, and so a lot of the stuff we do is kind of like you talked about earlier. We hammer down on the scouting, and then when it comes time to hunt it, we're, like, probably a lot more aggressive than we should be in a lot of cases, and we burn a lot of spots, but we just move on to the next one.
Because you got tens of thousands of acres.
You got all the spots you need, but I'm in a club this year, and I joined it last year, put a year of history into it, and then just joined it again last week. So I can continue to build history. So I'm having to kind of unlearn that because I'm like, you know what, maybe I shouldn't go bombing right through the middle of that thicket, you know, and hang up in the middle of it. So I'm curious about how you view putting pressure on your deer, especially when it comes to trail cameras and stuff like that. Like, how are you determining how close you want to put your cameras to the bedding, you know, and what is the process of figuring out a place where you can get to that point of, I know that at this spot on this weather front during this time period, I have a very good chance of seeing a target buck right here.
Yeah, so I'm complete opposite of the other guy. He was talking about checking cameras every 8 days. Like, oh, gosh, I don't even have time to go check my cameras that often. There's no way. Cell cameras are great. They have completely changed the game for me, but I still am not very – I don't go hard in. Like, I've always kind of felt like I don't really want a trail camera exactly where I'm going to hunt because I don't want the deer to avoid the trail camera. Mm-hmm. I do believe that deer avoid trail cameras. All I need to do on those areas, because I don't even scout them. I never scout on those. My spots I've hunted for years, I never, ever, ever, ever scout because I just know how the deer are going to act. I know what they're going to do. All I need is the trail camera to take a picture of him here or there. I don't need it to tell me exactly when he's there or anything like that. I just need to know he's in the area. If he's in the area, I've got the plan laid out that he's going to use. I've created the habitat in a way that I know what he's going to do when he's feeding. I know what he's going to do when he beds. I know what he's going to do during the rut. I need to know what travel corridor I need to get on. That's about all I need to know. I just need to know that the deer is there. So when I get a picture of a big buck that I'm targeting that I want to kill, I just need to know he's in the area. That's all I need. And then I hunt it appropriately, very, very carefully. I don't want my wind blowing in his thicket ever, 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 ever. I make sure my access doesn't mess him up. Because a lot of people may have the deer, they've got the plan, but then their access messes them up. Or, you know, they're busting deer in and out of their stand, and that messes your whole hunt up. I mean, around here, you don't have very many deer. You better not spook a doe, like, because that might be your only chance.
Yeah. Well, so you gave us some stories upstairs on a couple of different bucks that you shot out of the same exact tree or the same spot, maybe during the same year or maybe like over multiple years. How did you figure out that spot? Like, what led you to be like, this is the spot that I'm going to be able to hunt for years to come? Like, the scouting of that year, the camera placement, the hunts, like, how did you kind of form that hypothesis and then use it for years to come?
Well, it's not really a set thing that happens. But one of them was just like when I first got the property, the one that's small property, well, there was a spot for a food plot. It had been a row crop or whatever. And I was like, man, this is a pretty neat little area for a food plot. And I didn't hunt it right. In fact, there was a giant that I didn't kill because I didn't know how to hunt back then. And I went up finding his sheds and stuff. But like, Just I put the food plot there, and then it was kind of all just sort of, you know, old open pastures around a little travel corridor. Well, I just got lucky. It just happened to be a great travel corridor, but then over the time of learning how to hunt and learning what to do, I started making things. All right, well, I need this little area to be thicker. I need some bedding right here. I need some bedding right there. So it's got two or three little bedding areas right in the middle of this corridor, and the food plot's just right there too. And the food plot's not a beautiful food plot, but it's just little strips and stuff going through some tall grass, lots of like edge feathering around it. So it's not just goes from straight big open canopy timber straight down to beautiful manicured food plot. It's sort of a brushy little food plot, but I can sort of walk up into it. And like what Adam, he always talks about, he said, you know, like on the Home Improvement show, you know, Mr. Wilson, he's got his eyes is all you can see looking over the fence. That's how I want to hunt my spots. I want to be able to come in there and access it to where all I'm doing is looking over the fence into where the deer are, And then when I leave, they don't even know I was there. I walk back out. I can walk out with deer on the field. They don't even know I was there.
Mm-hmm.
So if I don't kill, I'm not spooking them.
Gotcha.
We've got to talk about how you do your stand setups, because that's something that's interesting to me. Is you're talking about you're setting up spots that you can get in and out cleanly where the deer can't see you. Can you give us some examples of how you go about doing that and what some of the different setups look like to allow you to be able to do that?
So terrain features are great. So if you've got a hill that, you know, you can look down into a food plot or whatever, if you can use the terrain to your advantage, stay below the hill and into your stand. If you want to look right back there, there's a shooting house. Well, there's a great big food plot right there that you – I know y'all can't – the listeners can't see it. But there's just a little bit of a rise right here. All right, that food plot is all right there to the right. When I walk down this fence row, there's a cedar tree that's right beside the shooting house. I walk – right there straight towards the shooting house with the cedar tree blocking it, I can get up in that stand with deer on the food plot and they never see me. And you look right here, if you was just to walk straight towards the shooting house, well, you walk across right across the right, the top of the ridge, and every deer in the food plot or even in the timber that's just sitting there bedded next to the food plot can see you.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use terrain features. You can, I mean, a lot of people use switchgrass to screen their access in and out. I've never done that. I'm not against it, but just use what you got. You can just cut down some trees, make it a little bit brushy right there in front of your shooting house. Different things like that. I actually left a bunch of sweet gums in one spot, which I hate sweet gums for habitat, but hey, when they're all thick and brushy, that spot that I've killed so many bucks out of, it's literally a sweet gum thicket that I just keep bush hogging, and it's stump sprouts, and it's just gnarly, and deer don't want to walk through it, but I can walk right down beside it and slip up in my tree and in and out of it with the deer never knowing I'm there. I know the deer aren't going to be there, and I can get in and out quietly, easily, watch deer out there. If the deer's on the field and I'm ready to go, I can walk out. They never even know I was there.
Now, do you do anything preparation on the ground to allow you to get in and out more quietly?
Do you come through with
a blower or anything like that?
Sometimes I do. Not a lot of times. I'm bush hogging the path. I want it to be kind of grassy, you know, or a trail or something like that. A lot of my fields, I'm coming in from fairly open areas.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of coming through like what one of our past guests, Josh Driver talks about negative terrain, like terrain or habitat that deer aren't going to be in during daylight hours.
Yes.
So he talks about like the open timber, big open bottom, stuff like that, using it for access.
This pasture right here.
Yeah. Like it's
that fence row is exactly what he's talking about.
But it's like matching negative terrain or negative habitat where deer aren't going to be at, but making it where they can't see you from that positive habitat, the positive terrain where they're going to be bedded at. Because again, you'd be walking right across this open field. If they're bedded on the edge of the food plot or the edge of the field, they can still see you. So still having some way to hide yourself, slipping into that spot, getting up in that tree nice and clean without being seen. And that's the big advantage, especially on like private land, is you can spend so much more time thinking and analyzing how can I get in and out clean without screwing this up.
And you have to take that time, because you can have the absolute best food plot. I mean, corn, beans with greens all up underneath it. You can have the best deer, but a lot of people mess up their target buck because of their access. It's like they've done so much work to prepare for that. They've done everything that they needed to do. They've got the deer there. They've got the pictures of him there in daylight, and they go hunt it and like, well, he just don't ever show up. Well, guess what? You probably just spooked that deer. The deer probably smelled you walking in, or saw you walking in, or you spooked something walking in that wasn't him, but he was probably right there close.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, even that doe or four point that's out there on the food plot that sees you that you think, well, it wasn't him, well, he might have been 50 yards inside the woods watching.
You know, it's hilarious. When you drive up here on I-65 going north and you come across the river and everything, you'll see these tower stands in these shooting houses in, I mean, 200 yards from any tree line, no cover around.
Smack
and,
in the middle
and I'm
of
like,
the field.
I'm like, how the hell are you getting in or out of that without deer seeing you? And you can't.
It's impossible.
And it's like, that is the funny thing. Unless you have somebody like, you know, you're on an active farm where you can drive trucks around and stuff like that, and you could have somebody come pick you up and drop you off in a vehicle. Maybe deer get a little used to that. But still, it's like people set up. And I've seen this, and I've been guilty of it too on some of our private land, like our family farm in Bibb County, is you have spots set up that or once you get in it, it's great. But it's like the access sucks because you either have to walk by really good potential bedding locations, or you're so exposed that when you have to leave or get to it, especially whether it's in the dark or you're coming in and out during the daylight, whatever it is, like you're going to get seen by deer. And like maybe like that buck doesn't see you, but like you said, you're educating the does, and the does aren't acting right. And the does are like maybe staying away from that location until right at dark or even just after dark. You're hurting yourself from a shot opportunity standpoint. And that could be from a tree stand setup and like where you have terrible access and you have to either go busting through a lot of brush or you're just a super open right next to a quality food source or and bedding cover. And I think another thing that people don't take consideration of, especially during bow season, you're a big bow hunter, is having stand sites set up in areas with like, say, a bunch of oaks are dropping. A lot of times those deer will bed underneath those dropping oaks. Like if the water oaks are dropping, a lot of times, that buck may be bedded there. He may have a little brush pile something close by that he'll bed in. And if you're walking through a wide-open oak stand to try to go climb up a tree, there's a good chance, even though you can maybe see 150 yards or something through that cover, there's a good chance a deer could see you and skirt out the backside that you never see and then completely, potentially ruin that spot or at least ruin that hunt from any other deer coming in there, especially if it goes blowing back through a bunch of other bedded deer.
Yeah. Well, and like those areas like that, you know, you want to walk like a deer. You want to sound like a deer. You don't want to walk with the gait of a human when you're walking into some of those areas that are kind of marginal, like timber, like those two bucks that were killed that same stand on the different farm, that's a timber spot. And my conditions that I like to hunt it is literally right after a rain in the morning where the next morning's going to be 30 degrees. That's the conditions to kill them in there. It's like they bed down because they moved pretty good that night. They bed down and then they get up early in the morning and start traveling or pushing does and stuff. And I've slipped in there quietly. And, I mean, there's a lot I could do to make all of these spots better. I just don't have time.
Yeah.
But when you take time to make your best spots completely perfect, flawless, they're just gangbusters. I mean, it's like you've got the perfect laid out plan and then you just go to execute it.
When you think turkey calls, think of Houndstooth. Houndstooth Game Calls is a company based right here in Alabama, actually based out of Tuscaloosa, and they have been making some of our favorite turkey calls since 2012. Y'all head on over to their website, see what they got. They got a little something for everybody. They have a huge selection of different mouth calls, different cuts, different reed configurations. I like to go on there and get 5 or 6 different mouth calls and just run them, see which ones I like the most. You know, some days I might like the KB Hen, some days I might like the Ghost Cut. Some situations I might like the Country Girl call, you know, that I can cut on really hard, where on other situations I might like the All Pro that I can get a little bit softer on. Bottom line, there's something for everybody and something for every situation. And hey, you can get 15% off of your order at Houndstooth Game Calls by using the promo code SOP24. That's SOP24. Use that promo code. It'll get you a discount and it helps out the podcast.
Man, Mark's Outdoors is your one-stop shop for everything outdoor and shooting related. They're a family-owned business that's been around for over 40 years now, been serving the Birmingham area, but now they have opened their doors to everyone across the United States through their online store. Again, me and Andrew have been using Mark's Outdoors for years now. They have unbelievable supplies of literally anything that we need we can pick up from Mark's Outdoors. They're even carrying different saddle companies, sticks, platforms, the whole nine yards at Mark's Outdoors. And again, if you don't live in Alabama and you don't want to make the drive to Birmingham, you can go over to their website, marksoutdoors.com, and actually shop on their online store to get awesome deals on different products that you may be needing right now and be able to get to you in a very timely manner as well. So give Mark's Outdoors a try. We promise you, you'll enjoy them. They have unbelievable customer service and some of the best guys in the industry. TruLock Chokes has been made in Georgia since 1981 and offering a wide range of chokes, over 2,000 different chokes for all kinds of shooting activities. You might be wondering why you'd want to purchase a TruLock choke, and it's to improve your shotgun performance. Absolutely guaranteed. And as a great example, we have Andrew Maxwell here. And Andrew, you've had some pretty good luck, again, kind of switching out chokes and trying out the Precision Hunter choke from TruLock. So, Andrew, what's been your experience so far?
Yeah, I've used the same choke for several years now. I never really thought much of it, and I got the TruLock choke in. I patterned my gun with the first choke at 30 and 50, and then I switched to the TruLock and changed from 30 to 50. And the 50-yard pattern on my gun with the TruLock choke is unbelievable. Like, everybody's jaws were dropping. Like, when we were out there with Mike and Sam, we were all super impressed. I mean, it's throwing a better pattern at 50 now than it was throwing at 40 before my old choke.
And Andrew, you're shooting the Precision Hunter choke from TrueLok. It's a great option. Same chokes I have in my shotgun. So guys, if you want to give TrueLok a shot this spring, you can head over to truelokchokes.com. That's truelokchokes.com. You can also use the promo code Southern at checkout at truelokchokes.com and save 10% on your order. Again, give TrueLok a shot this spring, especially if you're not happy with the performance of your shotgun, and shoot with a more deadly pattern with TrueLok. I think another important thing that we can talk about and really hit home on, and this kind of goes from both public and private land perspective, if you have a really good spot, and some of our, a lot of our more successful podcast guests that we have on the Hunt Public Land do the same thing, is they are very strategic of when and how they go about hunting certain spots. It's not like, you know, if you have a really good rut spot, they're not going in there during bow season and trying to hunt it 7 or 8 times, just trying to get lucky that that buck's going to be coming through that location. Or like a really good, like say they have a doe group. We've got a couple of guests that come to mind, like have a really good doe group that they know pretty consistently when those does come to heat. They're not going to try going there to shoot a doe in their early bow season.
Yeah.
They're going to go shoot a doe somewhere else
yep.
that they're not worried about rut hunting, and they're going to wait for that spot to get prime, and then they're going to go hunt it a few times and capitalize on that buck. And I think that's a huge part, especially on private land, especially if you don't have a ton of acreage. When I say ton of acreage, if you don't have more than 500 acres, it is super easy to burn some stuff up very easily if you're hunting every weekend or every couple, you know, a couple days a week, and you're bouncing around from spot to spot before it gets really, really good. And that kind of comes back to like the difference between really good rut hunters versus the kind of guys that can kill them outside the rut. Some of the guys that kill them outside the rut have certain scenarios or situations where they understand how to hunt an area that lets them capitalize on other parts of the season. You've killed some deer early bow season, also late in the season as well. But it's like, especially if you're trying to target deer during the rut, it's like you've got to have the conditions right, the right wind, and also on a small property, almost like let your neighbors pressure everything around you and wait for it to get good and those deer get sucked on their property, whether it's 20 acres or whether it's 2,000 acres. Wait for it to get really, really good and go in there and capitalize on it. And it's one of those things that's like, you know, if you're a kind of guy that you want to hunt 5 days a week, if you had the opportunity to do it, go hunt a lot more public or get in a huge lease, 7, 8, 10,000 acre lease that you can bounce around and do stuff on. But if you got some smaller properties or you just don't have that much time to hunt, it's like scout religiously, understand your area, but also understand how you can hunt it during the rut and then wait for that time to get right and then go in there. And then, as you know, guys like Andre DeQuista talk about, surgically remove that buck from the herd.
Yes.
Like, it's like a scalpel knife. You're coming in there, you're cutting him out, and you're not doing anything else.
That's right. And, like, you know, you're going to go hunting on, you say you take a weekend to go hunt. Well, the weather doesn't always cooperate. Maybe you get the same exact wind the whole entire time, and it's not the right wind to go hunt your best spot. Well, take some does out. I mean, we harvest does like crazy. My little boy, I turn him loose. Like, anytime he wants to shoot a doe, buddy, we're shooting a doe. Between the two of us, we killed 28 this year. And I pretty much let him shoot a doe every time he wanted to. And I wanted him to get used to, you know, an experience to know, like, hey, when a deer comes in, this is how we act, this is what we do. And so, like, he's comfortable shooting. So it's like, you know, I love taking him hunting with me because he's a lot of fun. But, like, I want to set him up for success. Like, I want to let him shoot some does. I want him to feel comfortable pulling that trigger. I want him to feel comfortable with everything. Instead of, all right, let's go kill a big buck, put all that pressure on him, make him feel like he's got to make the perfect shot because this is the only chance you're going to see this buck. Well, when he's already done this with several does, well, he walks in there and that buck comes out, buddy, he's ready. Bam, he's got the deer down. Like, so, like, use those days that aren't great. Maybe do habitat work. That's what I do a lot of times. It was the rut down in West Alabama. I knew I wasn't going to have very many days to hunt, but it was going to be a really good burn day. And I said, you know what, buddy, we're not going to hunt today. We're going to go burn some fields off. Because I know that sometimes it's better to do habitat work on those days that are just marginal or not that great than to go try to chase some buck that's probably not going to show up with 60-something degrees and warming temperatures and, you know, the conditions weren't right. Use those days to do your habitat work, or use those days to go shoot some does. Most properties have way too many on them. Have you some spots set aside that, hey, this is not really a great buck spot, man, go whack your does there. Take them out of the herd, reduce the competition, you know, reduce some miles to help your bucks reach their potential.
Yeah, we even have, like I keep drawing it back to some public land guys who talk about the exact same thing, where if they don't, they have a spot where they have a certain weather condition that they need to go hunt it, and they might go 2 years and not hunt that spot because it just never lines up. But then year three, they get it, and they go in there and they kill a really big deer.
Oh, yeah.
And you just, but that's why you got to have 10, 15, 20 plus spots that you can choose from, you know, so being a public land guy, so you don't kind of pigeonhole yourself or whatever. I wanted to drill down a little bit further on travel corridors and what that kind of means to you, because I've heard you mention it several times already. You kind of touched on it a little bit earlier, but what are the travel corridors that you're focusing on? Like, what consists of a travel corridor?
Okay, so basically, my favorite travel corridors are when you've got several little bedding areas and you can kind of slip into the side of it where bucks are going to be cruising looking for does. So when I'm hunting the rut, I want to be in the woods. I want to be in something close to something thick. Like when I hunt public land, my travel corridor was a whole bunch of blowdowns. It was like a straight line wind came and blew down a whole bunch of oaks in a line. And this line went for 300 yards, and then it's like it made a T, and there was oaks going the other way. Well, I got slipped right into the edge of that T. I want to know where – I want to be right there where the bucks are going to be looking for does, because does are trying to get away from the bucks. They don't like the bucks. They don't want them chasing them all the time. They want somewhere to – run in, slip out, and the buck have to look for them to where they can get away. And I don't know if you've ever watched, you know, a buck chasing a doe in one of those thickets like that. You know, they're pushing them around the edge of that thicket. They're dipsy-dealing around. The doe's running a figure eight all around through there. There may be another buck trying to come in there. Well, if you're right there on the edge of that right there, I mean, you know, you're just in a hub for bucks to come back and forth. And those bucks are – they want to travel that thicker area. They want to travel the edge of that. They want to look for those does that are trying to hide off in there, scent check them and stuff like that. So, like, anytime you can get a travel corridor between bedding thickets, when a buck loses a doe or when a buck's chasing a doe, that's a lot of times where they're going to go. And so you want to be right there. And, you know, you've got the travel corridors from bedding to food, but during the rut, I'm more focused on bedding.
Okay. So in a flatland situation, what might a bedding area, like you mentioned, like the blowdown, so it's just blowdown, just thick stuff, I guess?
Yeah. So like for instance, I'll use the row crop property, for instance. So there's like a, there's like some really, really big fields that I've, it's not CRP, but it's, if you think of a CRP field, that's what these are. They're fields that I've just periodically burned. They're brushy. They're not pretty. They're thick. There's some cedars scattered through there. There's some little trees and little plum thickets and stuff like that. But it's a lot of grasses, just a big area of a bedding thicket. To hunt that bedding thicket would be very, very hard because you don't really know where to be. They could be anywhere. Well, then there's another one that's, you know, in, there's a little bit of just a strip in between there and another one that opens up in really big, it's like big hourglass shape. Well, right there at the where those hourglass come together, there's a little small strip, 50 yards, that they've got to cross to get to the other one. And they want to get to the other one because there's going to be deer in both of them. And if you slip into the side of that little hourglass and sit right there, there's bucks will start cruising through there. A lot of times on up in the morning, something like 9:30, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. By the time you're ready to get down, those bucks start getting up and cruising back and forth to those two bedding areas. And so you're right there waiting for that buck to just come. And, I mean, you better not be on your phone because a lot of times they're trotting across it. They're moving pretty quick across there, but that's mm-hmm. you're just keying in on those little spots those bucks want to go check for more does.
What about the tree farm property? Like, let's say a place that it's maybe not cattle, maybe it's not row crop, but it's pine trees. I think you mentioned you had a property like that. How might it be different on a property like that where a lot of times those pines are kind of thick, you know, underneath?
That's a lot tougher. Yeah. That's a lot tougher because you've got just so many vague areas.
Oh, yeah.
But you...
That's
but
a great word, too.
They're all vague, and that's probably the hardest to hunt, in my opinion. I mean, my least favorite place to hunt is a gigantic pine plantation. But where I look for on those places are transitions. So maybe you've got a different stage, pines, right? Like you get small pines, big pines. Those are transitions I look for. Some little riparian buffers, you know, or SMZ zones, stuff like that. Those are some areas to look for. Even food plots. A lot of times you can use food plot to pinch deer down, because a lot of times those bucks aren't necessarily going on the food plot, but they're going to run the back side of it and check it. They're going to try to cover as much ground possible and stay hidden the whole entire time. So you may be sitting on a food plot looking towards the pines. You never see any of these deer. 50 yards back in the woods is where it's all happening. They're all running around the back side of it. They're scent checking it. And a lot of times they're smelling you if you're not careful. And you never even know the deer was there. You sit all day and you don't see a deer. Well, that's because they were just right there inside the woods, and they're traveling behind it. They're trying to stay covered and check as many areas as they can.
Yeah, man, I got a spot just like that that I tried to hunt last year. I tried to slip up the backside on it, and those pines were so thick that I could not get within 150 yards of that food plot. So this summer I'm going to cut a trail in there so I can take advantage of something like that. But I was curious about that because that's how my club sets up. It's a pine plantation, the whole thing. I mean, they cut right down to the creeks in a lot of spots. Yeah. Not that many hardwoods, a lot of thick stuff. But I mean, I know there's good bucks on the place. We found a pretty big deadhead like the first time we went out there, like a pretty nice buck. And I just haven't put enough time into it yet, but I'm trying to find some spots like that I'm going to be able to hunt for years to come. Because I think a big highlight of this conversation is, like, it's not like a one-year thing, you know. Yeah. To achieve that higher level of success, like, it has to compound over years, and you got to figure spots out and put years into figuring them out, and then you can, you know, reap the benefits over time.
Yeah, I'm probably slower and less aggressive than a lot of people do. You know, I like to find a spot and homestead from public land. I go to one gate. I don't worry about anything. I learned that whole entire gate. I learned that whole entire spot. I figure it all out. I may hunt three or four different locations, just kind of see how deer act. And I like to stay back and not try to be right on top of them the first time I hunt, unless I just know that I know that I know. But a lot of times I want to observe how deer use the property, observe how they're using those areas. And then when the weather's right, that's when I go in and go for the kill.
And this is something that was a good segue that I want to talk about. Again, a lot of people are hearing the conversation, all this guy's got some awesome private land, hold 9 yards because I hunt it. Well, recently you started getting into some public land hunting, okay? And had some really good success killing some really nice old mature bucks on public land. As I guess a way to challenge yourself, but also to kind of spite people that were saying, you know, you know, maybe at church, where we're like, oh man, this guy's just got some primo property. That's why he's killing all these freaking, you know, absolute top echelon deer in Alabama.
I heard he shot him on high fence.
Yeah. but I want to talk a little bit about that. And again, just how you've gone about hunting that public, kind of like what you're saying, like scouting, learning the area, observing and kind of moving in for the kill. Because that's the cool thing about you, is like you've been able to translate what you've been doing on the private land hunting to public land, where you don't get to be able to manage habitat. You don't get to like necessarily do a bunch of pre-hung stand sets or anything like that. But let's talk a little bit more about like that journey of how you kind of moved, not exclusively in a public, but started kind of focusing a little bit on public as well, as almost as a way to kind of add more variety to your hunting, but you're still able to capitalize, you know, hunting with a bow, killing some really good deer doing that, and some older deer too. So I mean, what was like the when you first decided to go do this again? I think you said like 4 years ago or five.
That was last year.
It was last year was the first time. Well, listen, all right, well, you learn quick. You learn very quick. So with you starting to do this last year, when you had the goal like, hey, I'm gonna go kill a buck in public, okay, what was like your first steps of like the first things you were going to go do? You're talking about you went to a certain gate. I guess you kind of liked what was behind it habitat wise, but like day one when you went out there, I mean, were you scouting? Was it preseason? Was it during season?
Well, so day one when I went out there last year, my buddy that hunts with me a lot, he actually won a truck too on AON with the deer he killed on my farm. But he was wanting to pay me back, you know. So I was actually down in South Alabama. He texted us, hey man, I just saw a really, really, really good buck. And I'd already been telling him, I was like, man, when you want to go to the refuge, I want to go hunt the refuge with you. And he says, so he found this deer, and I told him, I said, look, I don't care anything about being on that deer. I just want to hunt with you. And he said, well, we're going to go in this gate. So I just start studying maps. I'm looking at everything. I'm step back, look what's going on here. And I saw this little spot, and I said, hey, man, what about this area? We're going to go in there in the morning on a, you know, I was going in there blind, and mm-hmm. I said, what do you think about this area? He's like, yeah, it's got some trees in there you can climb. I was like, okay, that's where I'm going to try to go. Because I was going way past him. And so I go in there. It gets daylight. I shot a deer, And I get down. I'm like, oh, my gosh, dude, this is the X. Like, this is his spot. He goes, well, I saw him back this way. I'm like, dude, he's going through here, like, a lot. And so I said, we got to get back in here, like, this week. I said, it's hot. And so we go back in there. We hunt one more morning. I saw a bunch of deer. And we still didn't see the buck again. And I said, man, I really feel like it's going to happen this afternoon. I was like, the conditions are set up. I said, it's going to happen this afternoon. He goes, all right, let's go again. So we went back that afternoon. And in that same spot, the deer steps out. I see him crossing. And one of my other keys is 90% of the bucks I kill, I grunt in. I always want to be set up to where I can blow a grunt call. The deer cannot see into or through or around where I'm sitting. I want the deer to have to come look for what made the sound. Like if you've ever been in wide open hardwoods and you set up in a tree, you see a buck and you call at him and he's standing there from 50 yards and he can see 100 yards past you, that deer is most likely not coming up in there. But if you're set up over some structure or around some thick stuff or a bedding thicket or something like that, well, that deer can't see through that bedding area. He's going to have to try to circle downwind of you. If you've got something where he can't really circle downwind of you, he's probably just going to walk right straight up in there where he can see down in there. So anyways, that's what happened here. The deer was not going to come in range of me. But I was on his X. I was on a spot he liked to be. And so when I called to him, he bristled up, I mean, came running in, ears pinned back, and 25-yard shot right through the pumping station. And so my buddy told me about the deer, and he put me on the deer. But I found the X that he wanted to be and where he wanted to go. And I was in a position where I could call to him, and he was like, oh, no, who is in my spot, you know? So taking that, going back to that same public land but a different spot, I was like, I want to learn this spot. And I hunted it quite a bit. Killed a doe in there, one of the first hunts I was on. And just, you know, took my time checking every little nook and cranny of the whole spot. And it was a pretty big spot, and it was a heavily, heavily, heavily pressured spot. I mean, four or five trucks. I would get there first and come back, and there'd be four or five trucks in there after me. I mean, every day. I think it got hunted a lot on the days it wasn't supposed to get hunted. But that's how pressured this spot was. And so, like, I was kind of watching how people would hunt it and watching what people would do. And I'm like, man, that's a great spot. But, dude, why is he going in there? Like, he's messing that whole spot up. And I would literally sit there a lot of midday hunts and people get ready to leave and, dude, push deer to me all the time. Like, these deer were just, they knew how people accessed and they were watching that. And so I kind of used that to my advantage. And like, well, where are these people going? Where are they hunting the most? I want to hunt somewhere totally different. Spots that people weren't really hunting. And finally honed in on a deer that I wanted to kill and found the spot that I wanted to do it. And started getting right. I jumped in there and killed him. And he did exactly like what the other deer did. He was chasing a doe or something, and I just heard something snap behind me. I was actually looking at a different buck, and that was chasing a doe, and I was grunting at it, trying to get whatever was behind me to come check it out. Well, sure enough, out of nowhere, here he come running right straight in. I almost didn't have time to get my bow ready, and I shot him, and same kind of situation. It's just like, you know, you've got to be set up in a space that a deer can't see through or around or to, and they're not going to come downwind to check it. They're just going to rush right in there.
There's so much to talk about,
man.
With this. Yeah. That first deer you killed, the one that, you know, your buddy had talked about, and you decided to kind of go to a different portion of the public compared to like where he was at, and you said you found the X. What told you it was the spot that buck wanted to use or had been using?
Especially, well, if it was kind of far from where you said your buddy saw the
deer.
It
was like 300 yards.
Okay.
It wasn't terribly far. And in fact, he came out of the same bedding area that he had seen him before, but he wasn't using the same trail he saw him before, because he was hunting right where he saw him before. Like, and he almost killed him that day. He had him like 55, 60 yards. Like, he was close.
Yeah.
Well, what I saw there was just a travel corridor, like a lot of different just transitions, like several different features that just like, man, that's just like a buck buck area. Like, I love different stage timber, different field edges, and all that stuff was coming together right there. And when I got in there, and, you know, I climbed a tree in the dark, and I was looking around, I'm like, scrape, 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 and then like, oh my gosh, rub, like good rubs, like fresh rubs, like good trees. Like, he was like tearing it up right there. It's like a hub. Like, he wanted everybody to know that was coming through that little travel corridor that, hey, I'm the alpha right here. Y'all better stay out of my spot. And whenever I was set up in his spot and he heard that grunt, he was like, oh no. And I mean, I buck roared nearly all of them up, but he didn't like it. I mean, he came running in. So you just have to look for those little things and know that you want to, the right deer you can make mad, he can't resist it.
Man, that's so it's funny, man, the buck roar thing. I'm always like, oh, I don't know if that'll work down here.
Oh,
the only people who say it doesn't work are the people who don't kill giant deer.
Our buddy Clifton Denny, who's been on the podcast a couple times, he talks about, he's from Arkansas, and he came down here to Alabama, hunted, you know, this kind of region of the state, and had tremendous success doing like what you're talking about, being aggressive, calling. You know, he loves the buck roar. And it's like, again, you see a lot of people do it on outdoor television, and I feel like a lot of people do it around here on younger age class deer, and that's why they get a negative response, or they're in an area that a mature buck's truly not using a whole bunch, or he's not comfortable at. And I feel like what you're talking about, if you're getting in his bubble in an area that he's already super comfortable, he's using it, it's got the thick cover, he can't see really well, but he's that upper echelon age class buck. Like, he's not a 3-year-old, he's not a 4-year-old, he's a 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old deer. And you do something like that, and the timing's right, like the time of the year's right,
yes,
and you really have that dialed.
That's key.
It's like, okay, you flip a switch and make it happen. I was listening to another podcast, the Ozark podcast. The guys up in they're up in Arkansas. And they had a dude on that talked tremendously about this. He's like, dude, he's like, if you don't grunt, he's like, you're not, he's like, you go in turkey woods, you call turkeys, you go elk hunting, you're calling elk. Why would you call a deer? Deer are constantly making vocalizations. And like those mature bucks, at least up there in the Ozarks and the mountains, are extremely aggressive during the right few days of the season. And he's like, if you time it right, you'll have tremendous success. And the guy they interviewed talked about that. I can't remember his name. We may try to get him on the podcast, talk a little bit more about it. But it's like, when people hear about calling aggressively, because we know some guys that are super successful killing big bucks, but they like, I don't ever call. Like, I don't want the deer to know I was there and all this kind of stuff. But then you have guys like yourself and other guys that we've interviewed that's like complete opposites. Like, dude, if I'm in the right situation, the timing's right, and the buck's there, I'm in his comfort zone, it's like, why not? Especially if you're bow hunting.
Well, there's a little bit of art to it. Like, you don't just go and buck roar around. Like, I'm not buck roaring out blindly. Like, I won't buck roar unless I have eyes on the deer, or at least know the deer's where he is, because I don't want to buck roar a deer and it not be able to see it and he circled downwind of me. So, like, for instance, that deer that was on that public, you know, my first note's not a buck roar. My first note is just see if he responds. Sometimes they respond to that. That's all you need to do. Sometimes it's and they respond to that. Well, sometimes that stops them. Sometimes they don't even care. They act like they don't even hear it. Other times, maybe they're running.
Mm-hmm.
The buck roar is just like to get their attention, and then they stop, put their tracks on. Then you like it's you have to kind of play off the deer. Like, you see the deer. Like, I want to see the deer. I want to know how he reacts. I want to know what his demeanor is to whether or not I'm gonna buck roar at him. And so a lot of times, if you see that they kind of got mad when you just did that little grunt at them, but they're, I'm not sure if I'm going to come that way, then you buck roar at them, that's usually when they just, oh, shoot, I got to get there. And they haul off running as hard as they can go right straight into your setup.
And I guess that's also another portion about doing it when you can see them, but again, having thick cover around you, because if he's that close, especially if you're in the timber, you can't see 100 yards, so he's inside 100 yards to you. It's hard for him to be able to circle you if he's that close. It's another thing if he hears you from 250 yards away, and then he's like, okay, I heard something. Let me start circling and kind of ease my way over there, dog leg and whatever people want to call it, to get into that spot, versus if he's that if he's that tight, you know, within, say, 100 yards, and again, we're not rifle hunting, we're talking bow hunting specifically here, or maybe rifle hunting if you just can't get a good shot out, maybe he's into some thick stuff. To have him break, that makes a lot of sense. And also, do you have any – so I've heard of other guys talk about, and this is kind of interesting because that guy, Brad, I'm thinking of from this other podcast, he's the kind of guy, and he talked about – he's like, I grunt at that deer. If I see him, he's like you said, I want to see him, and I'll grunt at him until – and sound realistic and everything. His whole thing is about being realistic and not just doing some crazy stuff, but being realistic, buck roar and everything else, where it makes sense. You know, you got to be close to a doe bedding area. You got to be close to, like, something that tells that buck's truly going to be on a doe or fighting another buck. And almost like reeling him in with those grunts.
Yeah.
It's not just like you grunt once or twice and that's it. It's like,
just like turkey hunting. Mm-hmm. Just like turkey hunting. I mean, you're they're not responding back a lot of times, but although that really old, that nine-year-old deer that I killed, 2 years in a row, I got a buck roar contest with that deer. Like, I would buck roar, he'd buck roar back at me. I'm talking about not just two or three times, like 10 or 15 times. And I mean, it just got so close to killing, just didn't have the right angle, or a tree was in the way or something every single time. But yeah, it's, you got to think about it like turkey, and I'm directional with it. Like, I don't just sit there and blow right straight at the deer. Like, if I know my wind's, say, coming to my right, and I want that deer to think I'm to the left, I'm blowing off to the left, not, you know, right at the deer. I want that deer to think he's got to get that way a little bit, and he's actually trying to get downwind of the sound, and I am instead where he's trying to get. So you're trying to use the wind, you're trying to use, you know, your terrain, your thicket, or whatever it is in your favor to make him think I'm over there. He's going to come downwind of over there, and he's going to be right in my wheelhouse.
Now, you got to talk about the timing, though, like the timing of, like, when this is effective, because it's not like you're doing this all season long. It probably is a very short window that it's
right around the rut, pre-rut.
Yeah.
Peak rut, post rut is about the only time this works.
Okay, yeah. And I guess also it's like reading that demeanor of that deer. Like, when you see that deer, like, is that a mature buck, and is it potentially a dominant buck for the area?
Yes, because, I mean, you can absolutely mess them up. I mean, there's some deer that just, they're not fighters. They're not brawlers. They're, you know, they're more docile. They're more, you know, lean back. Buck roar is not going to work on that deer. But, you know, your first couple of small grunts are going to show you, I mean, just reading deer, reading their body language and everything, are going to show you what type of demeanor they're going to have. If they're going to be mad, or if they're going to be like, yeah, I don't know. So you just kind of have to read the body language of the deer to know whether you go with the buck roar or not.
Is there anything that kind of characteristics, especially maybe what they do with their ears or how they put their head up?
I mean, they're kind of, you see their hair kind of bristle up a little bit, or, you know, their head kind of, they start posturing a little bit. That's when you hit them with that buck roar, and they're just like, oh, I'm coming.
Now, do you ever do it where you'll see a buck that maybe you're like, oh, man, is he mature? It's like, he's probably mature. You do it, and, like, he throws that head up, but his eyes get real wide or something like that. Like, maybe it's, like, not, like, a positive sign. Like, I'm sure you've had some where it's like –
oh, yeah. I don't call in every single one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to have times where it's kind of a last resort. Like, if you know that, hey, nothing else has worked, you're not going to kill that deer, try it. I mean, you're not going to – I've usually not ever ran them off with it, but sometimes it just doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. The grunting's so interesting. And it's like, I've heard more snort wheeze from Alabama deer in the past 2 years than I ever have previously, but it's because of where and how we've changed and been hunting.
Yeah.
In around those thick doe bedding areas where the bucks are pushing does earlier in the season, and actually seeing them snort wheeze and hearing them snort wheeze and snort wheezing at them and watching their body language, those mature bucks, and do the hair, like the deer I killed when we were hunting the mountains in Alabama. He was bumping doe coming up through the saddle, real thick, nasty spots up in the tree. And I could see his rack come through the woods, and I saw saw the doe in front of him, and he was kind of like stiff legging, kind of like behind the doe, like matching her pace. And like once or twice, he would turn and start running back down the hill. I'm like, what is he doing? And he'd like get out of sight, and he'd come back, and I can't see him very well. I can see his antlers from like 80 yards away, like 80, 90 yards away coming up the ridge. And he'd start coming back up again. He'd do it again. He'd like run back down the hill. I'm like, what is he doing? And I didn't realize afterwards there was another buck behind him that he was trying to keep off her.
Yep.
Well, he does it again. He starts coming back up, and I can tell. He's like, you can tell by his posturing, he's aggressive. So I'm like, dude, I'm going to snort wheeze at this deer. Snort wheeze at him. And, dude, second I snort wheeze at him, he lays those ears back, bristles up, and he starts kind of doing that, like, side leg dog walk between, like, that doe's coming up. She's not coming directly at me. She's like a 45-degree angle coming up to my right. And he gets between her and me, doing that whole that posturing kind of stays between
nose down,
yeah. head down, kind of like angle, and you can see on the footage, he's got his head kind of angled down, kind of like side on, yep. like coming between me and her. And anyways, he gave me a great shot opportunity. I was able to kill him with a rifle at like probably 75 yards, 70, 80 yards. And it was just interesting kind of seeing that. And then the year previously, had a buck, another mature buck I killed on another piece of public land, running a doe. So there's two bucks on this doe. There was a probably 3-year-old chasing this doe that was clearly in heat, and this other older buck was on his butt, dude, trying to get antlers in his butt, dude, yeah. running them. They ran this thicket down below me, and it kind of got quiet for a second, and like you hear grunting just the whole 9 yards, and all of a sudden you hear, and he did like 2 or 3 times, and I'm like, oh, I'm like, okay, and like I didn't even think about snort wheezing back at him, but I had the gun up. It was another gun hunt, and the second that doe, she came back out of that thick stuff, dude, she just came. I mean, flying out, and that big mature buck, he stepped out and just stopped for like a fraction of a second more than he should have. I shot him. He went down.
Didn't work out for him.
But it's cool, like actually seeing some of that vocalizations and actually seeing like how those mature bucks react to some of that stuff when the timing's right. Because again, if you were in there a month before the rut, probably not going to happen.
No,
he's probably like, what?
Not.
He's like, what's going? What is that? But it's like if you time it right, and especially kind of that earlier part of the rut, I think, that earlier part of the rut when those first couple of does come to heat, I feel like, dude, that's something I'm definitely going to focus more on this year.
Yeah.
On some of our hunts.
Well, also, I don't know about y'all, but I felt like growing up, a lot of the guys I grew up hunting around were like, man, I never hear grunts. Like, nobody ever heard grunts. Like, if you heard a deer grunt, it was like a big deal. Kind of like you're talking about with the deer track back in the day. You go back to camp, you're like, I heard one grunt. Everyone's like, no way, really? And I think that's changed so much for us in the last couple of years because of how we've been hunting, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we're hunting in the places that they do that kind of stuff. It's
that's
like,
right.
He's not going to walk out in a food plot and just be grunting around, most likely.
Yeah, you're not going to hear a lot of buck roars out on a food plot.
No.
I mean, that's the thing, that buck roar is so distinct and it's so cool when it happens in the woods. And I mean, they're not quiet with it. They're loud and they're aggressive with it.
How long after I snort wheeze when we were in South Alabama on that SOA hunt did the Buckeye shot come in? Because I was snort wheezing. I was blind call snort wheezing because we had talked to a guy that did that.
I don't know. I'd have to look at the footage.
It wasn't long.
It wasn't that well because it was only an hour between when I shot mine and you shot yours.
And we had a hot doe in there, had a doe get bred in front of us, $5 on her. This one buck fought off all the other 4 bucks, bred her, and then a bigger buck ran him off. It was crazy. Andrew shoots one of them. And then I'm like, dude, I'm going to start snort wheezing because I'm like, there's a hot doe here. There's like a ton of bucks around. And I start snort wheezing. I probably snort wheeze, I don't know, in the matter of 15, 20 minutes, probably 5 or 6 times. And not very long afterwards, the buck I shot, he came through, head up, big or mature buck came through, slipping there, and he got shot.
Yeah.
but it's crazy. Like, if you get in those little pockets, and again, it kind of comes back to like what we were talking about earlier, is you got to find those areas that those mature bucks feel comfortable moving through, but it's got the does, it's got the travel corridor, it's got everything you're needing. It's not like you walk in a wide open river bottom or like, you know, timber company or timberland where it's just wide open stuff. Like, there's got to be a reason that mature buck's there. And it's kind of funny, like, you hear guys talk about, we've interviewed dudes, or maybe interviewed, but I know some guys personally who's shot big mature bucks for whatever reason, cruising through wide open timber, not using any kind of thick stuff, but during the rut, like, they're just trying to take that shortcut from one thicket to other thicket, and they're not taking, like, the path. They're taking the path of least resistance, but it's through, wide open timber.
I mean,
pines, you can see 150 yards through. But it's, like, during that time of the year when they are just trying to go from point A to point B as quick as they can to get to the next spot. And it's, like, other than that little time of the year, when they're like making that, like, you've got to be in and around that thick stuff that they're the most comfortable cruising through and make those movements where you can kind of get an opportunity at them.
Yeah, you're not going to be consistent. I mean, there'll be deer like across this wide open field right here and then the rut, like, you know, but you're not going to be consistent killing them in areas like that. Down on the row crop property, there's just areas where you can literally see a mile. You're going to see some deer cross that area. But you're not going to be consistent. You're never going to be on the right spot at the right time when they're doing that. But when you're on those bedding thickets, and if you can't find them on your property, go create them.
Yeah.
Go make them. Go find those spots and, like, create it and make it a hub for bucks to cruise and travel down. And so, like, that's what's key is when you're on those spots, you're going to be a lot more consistent. You're going to have a lot better hunts. You're going to have, you know, more exciting hunts, those hunts where it's almost like elk hunting, you know, they're bugling and you're calling them and all that kind of stuff. That's what's fun. catch a mature deer doing all that, putting on a show, dude, there's nothing greater to have a bow in your hand whenever all that happens.
Oh gosh.
Absolutely. No, and that's a good point. It's like you got to find or create those spots if you have access.
Yeah, public land, you just go find them. Private land, go create them. And you can be so much more specific on private land of where you're putting them.
Mm. And see, that's why – so one thing that I want to – we talked about on the phone that we're going to work on and hopefully be able to film is try to have you come down and Kyle come down to my family farm and look at that place because it had been heavily cut. I told you it had been heavily cut about 12 to 15 years ago. Kind of naturally regen. It's a hellhole. Uncle got a mulching head on a – actually, not a mulching head. It's that brush head on a skid steer and did some clearing work and stuff and wants to run fires through it. But he wants to – do like what we're talking about, like how can we set that property up for like some unbelievable bedding locations where you can have some of that action because he's never had that down there. And also, but he's got his own perspective about putting a lot more trees back on the landscape, and that's why we want to kind of have that conversation, I think, with him about let's leave it maybe a little bit more open and have more of that native habitat and stuff that there's a ton of good food and cover, but it makes a buck super comfortable moving through that habitat instead of having just a bunch of timber out there. And I feel like if more and more people, especially as like more of the stuff that's being showcased in like video format of like what this can look like on properties, I think more and more people will get excited about doing some of the stuff that we're talking about.
Right.
Especially if you have access to some private land, whether it's through, you know, one thing I'd love to do at some point in the future, like we love hunting public land, but finding some, because can't really buy property right now, but if we could find a private landowner that to lease property through that would let you do some of this stuff, because it's hard to do any of this through a timber company. Timber company leases, they're not going to let you touch much of that timber.
Unless you can talk to them and tell them, hey, look, we need to knock out some invasives. We need to knock out the trees that aren't going to bring you any value. You may can go that route. I know the NRCS does cost share programs. That's what we do with a lot of our clients. If they're wanting some TSI done, a lot of times you can go through the NRCS, get a cost share program to go in there and do the TSI. And you hire a crew to come in there and they cost share it. And then there you go. You've got better timber, more healthy timber. Your trees that are going to be your timber production trees are going to be healthier and grow and be ready to cut sooner. And at the same time, you're going to help habitat, help your hunting, help the turkeys, help the quail, all of those things all in one thing. You know, you're gonna do so much better then and enjoy your property even better.
Absolutely.
Awesome. I got one more question that I need to ask. It's kind of going back a little bit, but it kind of, again, goes back to the flatland travel corridors, the buck hub thing that you were talking about where you shot those bucks on public, and specifically like timber transitions. You got small timber transition to big timber. So are you looking for a lot of like linear edges that kind of run into each other? Because that kind of seems what I'm gathering.
Yeah.
So you're looking for a linear habitat edge, whether it be a field edge, a timber edge, or something else, maybe the edge of a slough or something, and trying to find where multiple of those come together and hunting right there.
Yep. But you just gotta have a place for your wind to blow to. Whether that be open field, open timber, or whatever, you gotta have that first of all. And if right there in all that X it doesn't work, then you're just going to find a leg left or right, or you know, in a different direction to where your wind will be safe. But yeah, like field edges, brushy field going to timber, or you know, pines going to hardwoods, or creek edge, SMZ zone, stuff like that is what I'm looking for.
Okay.
But it doesn't have to be in a straight line, but a lot of times it is. I mean, the way land is broken up and segmented, we've made straight lines out of everything. Property lines. Property lines are good transition zones. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody knows property line, that's where all the deer is going to be. I mean.
But that's why. That's why. Always been the case.
Because that area has been treated differently. So it's usually like somebody cut the timber on one side and didn't cut the other side. I mean, you got thicker brushy stuff, and then you got sunlight going through that thicker brushy stuff, and then you got, you know, bigger hardwood trees, but that little edge the sunlight got in there, you know, it's got waist tall, you know, grasses and weeds and forbs and stuff. Well, there's food and cover all along that same line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And they can move through it.
Mm-hmm.
So
it creates kind of like almost a soft edge too.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like it's not just a bam.
It's kind of like that feathered edge.
That edge feathering. That's right. That's right.
I love it, dude. I love it.
I'm excited. Alan, real quick, if listeners had any other questions for you or even want to reach out to you about consultation, how would they get a hold of you?
So you can get a hold of us with Native Habitat Project. So hunt@nativehabitatproject is my email. Or you can contact Landon Legacy. I mean, if you're, there's a lot of fans on here probably listen to Landon Legacy. Well, I'm going to be the Southeast rep for Landon Legacy. So I'm training with Adam and Matt and learning everything that they do on how they write the management plans and everything. And, I mean, I've been doing a lot of the work for a long time before I ever met them. But so if anybody's interested here, you know, you're wanting to get some of this work done on your property but don't know how to go about it, we're the guys to contact. We're huge on native habitat, and we're huge on making the land, you know, more huntable, more accessible, teaching you how to strategize where to put these thickets, how to access these thickets, how to, you know, set up your property to make it the most huntable it can be.
But not only doing that, but also boosting wildlife and
absolutely,
and especially like what we've talked about, which is going to be a big storyline with our family property, is hasn't been turkeys down there, or hasn't been turkey killed there in over 15 years. Hasn't been any heard or seen in about 7 to 10 years. And but there's turkeys in the general area, but that's one of the only properties that has some open ground around there, and kind of seeing like that transformation for other people's property too. Of like, if you want turkeys back, you know, you want better deer habitat, you know, this is a great opportunity to be able to kind of, you know, discuss with someone like yourself to kind of figure out, you know, what options are available from a private landowner. Or again, if you have a leased land, especially if you lease it through a private individual, how you could have that conversation with somebody about embedding that habitat, that property, the timber management, that makes everybody super happy.
Right.
So
right.
Absolutely. Awesome. Well, Alan, greatly appreciate you joining us for the podcast. It's been an awesome episode. Listeners, if you've enjoyed it, go leave us a 5-star written review on Apple Podcasts. We are quickly getting up to 1,000 reviews. Hopefully try to break that 1,000 reviews by early summer. If y'all would go leave us a review, that'd be greatly appreciated. Also, share this episode with a buddy, especially if you got a buddy that maybe could really benefit from a conversation like this. So thanks for everybody joining us, and we'll catch y'all back here on the next episode from the Southern Outdoorsman Podcast.
Y'all go ahead and write down the dates, June 28th through June the 30th. Go ahead and just mark those off your calendar so you can be at the Dalton Convention Center in Dalton, Georgia for the 2024 Mobile Hunters Expo. Y'all heard a ton of content from that expo last year that we posted. We talked about it a ton. Look, if you're the kind of person that listens to this podcast, this show was literally made for you. It was literally designed for you, which means you're going to love it. You know, all the best companies in mobile hunting are going to be there. A lot of the best deer killers in the Southeast are going to be there. A lot of our past podcast guests are going to be there. It's going to be an incredible event. And hey, if you've been looking to either get into a saddle or maybe a mobile lock-on setup or just a different kind of tree stand setup, I'm telling you, it's worth the investment to go to this show because they're all going to be there, and you will get to try all of them in person before you buy it. So you don't have to order something online and then wait for it and then try it when it comes in to see if you really like it. You're going to get to go put your hands on everything all in one day, test it all out, and figure out exactly what works best for you and have it taken care of before deer season starts. So like I said, go ahead and put it on your calendar, guys. It's a no-brainer. You got to be at the show. Again, it's Friday, June 28th through Sunday, June 30th in Dalton, Georgia. We absolutely cannot wait to meet you guys there and talk hunting. So we'll see you at the 2024 Mobile Hunters Expo in Dalton, Georgia.